Good evening, everyone, and welcome. My name is Julie Mayshuk. I'm Director of Global Programs in the 92nd Street Y's Belfer Center for Innovation and Social Impact. Thank you so much for joining us. It is my honor to introduce our event this evening on women and the 2020 election. And now join me in welcoming our guests this evening. Valerie Jarrett is a Senior Distinguished Fellow at the University of Chicago Law School and a Senior Advisor to the Obama Foundation. Ms. Jarrett was the longest serving senior advisor to President Obama. She oversaw the offices of public engagement and intergovernmental affairs and chaired the White House Council on Women and Girls. She currently serves as board chair of When We All Vote and co-chair of the United State of Women. And our moderator this evening is Emily Tisch Sussman, the host of the podcast, Your Presidential Playlist, and a leading Democratic political strategist. Thank you both so much for being here this evening.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. Hey, Emily.
Hey.
How are you?
Good. I'm excited to get chatting. When we had the idea to talk with you a couple months ago, it seemed like it was going to be a good time to talk. Now it feels like we need you more than ever.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you feel that way. I need you all too. I need you guys to vote.
Well, let's get right into it. Look, you chair the board of When We All Vote. You co-chair the board of United States of Women. And together, those two organizations have just launched the Gender Equity Voting Initiative. Can you talk to us about what exactly this initiative is doing?
Yeah, sure. Well, so let me take a step back and describe both organizations and then why we've come together at this important moment. So When We All Vote was launched by former First Lady Michelle Obama about 2.5 years ago. After the last presidential race, she was struck by the fact that 100 million Americans did not vote in that election. And so she started thinking, what's wrong with our culture that people don't appreciate how important it is for them to exercise the most basic responsibility of citizenship, and that is voting. And so she thought, well, let's have an organization that's nonpartisan. Let's take politics out of public service, if you will, and let's focus on meeting people where they are, and particularly closing both the age and the race gap. Disproportionately young people don't vote, and disproportionately people of color have been disenfranchised. And let's try to get everybody engaged in this process, and not just about one election or one candidate, Emily, but more importantly, all elections matter. And I'll talk about that in a second. The United States of Women grew out of the White House Council on Women and Girls that I had the privilege of chairing for all 8 years during the Obama administration. Back then, the executive director was Tina Chin. She's now the CEO of Time's Up. I serve on her board. And she and I decided, well, let's continue the work that we did from the White House as citizens, the most important office of all, after all. And so we created a not-for-profit, again, 501c3, nonpartisan, to cast a big net to say, let's put the best practices on what we're doing to close the gender gap. And everything from healthcare to small businesses for women, to education, to ensuring that women are actively involved in the democratic process, supporting women who want to run for office, and encouraging everyone to vote. And so those two organizations came together to say, we know that women are often the ones that are making the decisions in the families. They're the ones that motivate the rest of the family. So how about if we reach out and really start an initiative where women and girls who can influence their parents come together and really encourage everybody to be an educated voter. And the final thing I'll say on this is that over the course of this year, this devastating year in so many ways, in a sense, it's also been a very painful civics lesson. We now, people for the first time are saying, well, wait a minute, who is the police superintendent and who appoints that police superintendent? Well, mayors do, so you should care who the mayor is. Who are the prosecutors who are making decisions about whether or not to bring charges using their discretion? They all run for office. Who are the governors that are determining what the standards are, as well as with the mayors, for the kind of protections that we should take against this COVID and allocating resources, important resources, to our essential workers, our first responders, our healthcare workers, and working very hard to keep us all safe? And who is in Congress providing a check and balance to the executive branch? And so we've been meeting people where they are, asking them what issues are important to them, and then encouraging them to do their homework and figure out who are the candidates that best reflect their values and who they are confident have the track record, experience, temperament, and ability to get the job done. So that's in a nutshell of how these two organizations came together to focus on voting. And look, in the midst of the COVID, we know it is more challenging than ever to vote. And we want people to make a plan. For example, my mom is 91. Well, she decided she wanted to vote in person. And I encouraged her to do it during the early vote. So she went in when the polls first opened in Chicago on Saturday morning. They kind of moved her up in the line since she is a senior citizen. But still, she had to wait a half an hour to vote. We've seen people waiting 12 hours to vote. So you need a plan and try to do it early. If you're concerned about your health and don't want to go to the polls, find a legitimate drop-off box or put it in the mail, again, as early as possible. And that's really where so much of my energy is going right now. And look, we've seen record turnout. I was just looking at the number. Nearly 3 million people have voted early in this country. That's unprecedented. And I think it's a sign that people have an awakening to what their civic duty is and what the potential of their voices in a country that is based on democracy.
Now, you mentioned that the effort is really trying to get to people who are, I guess what we call low propensity voters, like hard to reach voters, people who don't normally get the messages. And that also that people are really looking at who is the police chief, who is the DA, like if those are the things they're concerned about, like who really oversees the offices of the issues they care about.
Yes.
I'll be honest with you, today I went on Instagram Live and filled out the California ballot with Whitney Port, who is an Instagram star, because she wanted to do it and she wanted to go through the whole thing. So I went to the California ballot with her. And even with the research, I had a little bit of trouble figuring out what each of the jobs oversees.
Yeah.
And helping her figure out what information she would want to fill them out. So how are these organizations, how are you working to get that information to people who are not inclined to vote in the first place?
Yeah, so well, we have our website, whenweallvote.org. I encourage everyone to go on, and it'll give you basic information. For example, whether or not your state allows mail-in ballots without a cause. What are the days where early vote begins and ends? What are the registration deadlines? So that people are informed. What happens if you get to the polls and you're not on the register and you want to vote? Do you just walk away or do you get to cast a provisional ballot? We want people armed with as much information as possible. As to the issues, you got to do your homework, just like we're back in school. I can't tell you what issues are important to you. You have to determine what issues are important to you. And then you've got to do a little work to see which candidates best stand for your positions. Not that they're perfect, because look, nobody's perfect on everything you care about. But you've got to choose between those who are on the ballot and who best you think is going to meet your priorities. And look, in Illinois, for example, in Chicago, we have a lot of judges that are elected. It feels like 2.5 pages of judges. Well, I have a really good friend who's a judge. I called him up. I said, would you walk me through what their track record is? Because I'm not familiar with a lot of these judges. And he took the time to do it. And so is it a little time consuming to do your homework? You betcha. But these people are making decisions that affect both your lives and your livelihood. And so it's worth it. If you have to stand in line, I think that employers, for example, should give their workers time off, and not just 2 hours, because we're seeing lines that could last up to 12. But we need, this has to be like an all-in to try to make it as easy and as fair and as honest and accessible as we can in the midst of this pandemic.
Well, look, there are going to be logistical challenges for sure for people. And I think some people are feeling maybe their vote may not make a difference. Like one of the questions that we got today was, I live in a red state. I don't live in a swing state. You know, I live in a blue state. We all hear those kinds of questions all the time. I think particularly for women voters, you know, we are in the midst of, you know, really 3 major moments, maybe 4 with the definitely 4 with the presidential campaign, global pandemic, a she session, a recession primarily burdened by women, and an awakening around racial justice in the midst of this gigantic presidential election. And I think a lot of women are feeling overwhelmed. Definitely. I think everyone is. And maybe thinking that their vote might not matter. So, you know, if that's the last thing they can get to, maybe they'll get to it on election day. So what do you say to them?
Of course, your vote matters no matter where you're located. Because again, remember, this isn't just for who's at the top of the ticket running for president. In your local elections, many of which are on the ballot right now, your vote will matter. It doesn't matter whether you're in a red state or a blue state. If you have a mayor who's running for election or your state legislature, for example, or your prosecutor, And even if you are in a state that is predominantly red or blue, and even if, say, everybody in that state is leaning towards one party, even in the local level, your voice is so important to be a participant in this. And so, yes, you might influence the outcome of the election, but you will out influence the momentum that the person who wins has behind them, or he or she has behind them. So if, you know, overwhelmingly you see that people are supportive of one candidate or another, regardless of red or blue state, that sends a message of where the country is. And hopefully it sends a message to the person who won about by how much they won. And so it does matter. And it is a responsibility of our citizenship. We do have to show up and participate. And I think that too often people think, well, what difference does one vote make? Well, last presidential election was decided by fewer than 100,000 votes, spread over three states. That matters. Not to mention, again, local elections are often much, much closer than that.
So I do want to take you back to the last election, if you can stomach it, work with me here. But so we saw how the media portrayed Hillary Clinton as the presidential nominee, as power hungry. It was really a very negative view, I think, of the media portrayal of her. But then in 2020, we saw a record number of women running for president. Did you feel like the media portrayal was different this time around?
In some aspects, yes. And there is safety in numbers. And we've made some progress over the last 4 years. But in other aspects, no, which is one of the reasons why a group of women around the country sent a letter to the media, which we released publicly, obviously, to put them give them a heads up that we're going to call out double standards, that for far too long, women have been judged in ways that men simply have not. Language used to describe women is just differently when they are vying for powerful positions, both in politics and in business, in life. And we aren't going to make the candidates defend themselves. We're going to defend them, and we're going to call it when we see it. And we did that before Vice President Biden even selected Senator Harris, because we were already seeing racist and sexist tropes being thrown at the people who were under consideration. So we wanted to check the media up front and say, we're going to call you out on it. And certainly we're going to call out everybody else involved. And this is not about partisan politics. This is about core decency, that women should be competing on an even playing field. And you look at somebody like Kamala Harris, where just this last weekend, the governor of Georgia is mocking her name. Well, you know what? He serves on a committee with her. He actually knows how to pronounce her name. It is racist, and it is intended to diminish her stature, make her seem like an other, that she doesn't fit in, and she's a member of the Senate. And so we're just not going to put up with that. And as I said, that has nothing to do with the fact that I am a Democrat supporting her candidacy. I just don't think it's fair and for women to be treated by this double standard. I'll give you another example. This came from a member of the Democratic Party towards her, saying that she was ambitious. Well, and this is before she was selected, that maybe she shouldn't be the vice president because she's too ambitious. Well, you tell me, Emily, when in our nation's history was there somebody who was in contention to be vice president of the United States who was not ambitious? You give me the name of any vice president from either party in our nation's history who did not want to be president.
Right. I'm not sure I really want a slacker in that job, so I feel okay with that.
Right. But when that word is used to describe a woman, it's somehow she's out of her place. And what we're saying is we have her back, and our place is wherever we choose it to be. And we expect everybody to catch up. It is the year 2020. This is the 100th anniversary of white women having the right to vote. We are half the population. We're graduating from college at higher rate than men. Get over it, men. We're coming. And the sooner you appreciate that and begin to embrace it, the more successful you're going to be, because we make it better. And now there are a record number of women in Congress, more than ever before. And I believe diversity is a strength, and that the decision making that's going to happen as a result of that sea change will be better for the American people.
Well, so I think a time that we really saw this in the last couple of weeks was the vice presidential debate with Senator Harris and Vice President Pence. It felt like it felt like the Senator Harris was kind of in a no-win situation. I mean, everyone, honestly, everyone who debate, I mean, Vice President Biden's in a no-win situation when debating Trump. Like, everyone who debates surrogates kind of in a no-win situation where there's sort of a balance between fact-checking and holding your own point to the point that you don't be fact-checking forever so that you're, like, stuck in their point. And she walked the line the way that she walks it. So did you think there was ever going to be like kind of a win for her? Like, was there ever a way that she was going to be able to walk that line with the media portrayal? It felt like from the polling, it feels like she won over the American audience, like the voter audience. But did you think the media portrayal of her, she was ever going to be able to walk the line?
Yeah, I think actually she did really well. And part of, I think, her success that night was she was authentic. You got the feeling you knew who she was. I mean, she was genuine. Her expressions were sincere. You could read them. Everybody knew what she was thinking, whether she said it or not. She looked like she wanted to be there. She was engaged. She was enjoying the back and forth. She was passionate. She looked right at the camera and spoke to the American people. And I think that authenticity and sincerity resonated with the American people. And I didn't actually see much criticism from the press that about the way she conducted herself. I think she, in the most clear but not offensive way, checked the vice president when he kept talking over her. She did it with a smile, which women tend to have to do. But she made it clear that she was speaking and she intended to keep speaking. And I think that that's something that, as a woman, we want to see women who are powerful be able to exert their power in a way that they're comfortable. And I thought she did a really good job. And I actually can't think of too many examples where the media criticized her appearance, the way she came off in that debate.
She's making history as the first woman of color, as a vice presidential nominee for a major political party, maybe the first female vice president. She's making history all over the place here. But some people feel like there's kind of an asterisk next to her nomination because Biden had pledged to pick a woman. Do you feel that's true, or do you feel like it still has all of the important representation to a lot of women in particular, that she is breaking all these glass ceilings?
I don't think there's any asterisks at all. I think there's an exclamation mark. Vice President Biden picked a strong, competent woman with a track record of experience. The reason he felt comfortable early on saying that he intended to select a woman is he knew he had an incredible pool from which to choose. He didn't say that in a vacuum. He said it in the middle of a Democratic contest running against some pretty extraordinary women. So I think he was comfortable saying the best in class are going to be women in this year's race. And he also wanted to send a message about his values and the fact that he knows that he will make better decisions with a strong woman who has a different set of life experiences than his own, but shares his values and his willingness to put the country first before self. And that will make that pair a stronger pair. So I think it was a very powerful signal. And in terms of who's looking up to this as a role model, look, I have on a personal note, my grandson is both Black and Indian. His father is Indian. And just became a citizen in 2016. He's from Canada via Trinidad, via India. And I love the fact that he's going to grow up thinking it's perfectly normal to have someone who looks just like him, who is a woman in this extraordinary position of power. And so, yes, for all the little girls of all colors out there, I think she's an incredible role model. But I think it's a very important message to send to our young boys as well.
I started my all-women.
Some grown men, I hasten to add.
I think there's some grown men who could definitely learn from her. I started my all-women podcast, your presidential playlist, because I felt that women were not often recognized as authorities on the issue. They were often only called upon as authorities when it was couched in their own personal experience, whether it was motherhood or lived experience. And then they had to use it as like a qualifier to then be able to speak about their work experience and their expertise. And of the people that comment on politics, 63% are still male. So we brought in women to the show, so they may not always have the platform. How do you think this election would have been covered differently if the commentary had been 63% women?
Well, it would have been better for sure, right? I think it would have been better. And it's interesting you say that, because I remember several years ago trying to encourage the media to look at who they're using as experts in their pieces and say, you know, you always go to men and you go to the people you know. It's just like oftentimes people who serve on boards. Well, who do I know I can ask to join the board? Well, no. Why don't you look at it more critically, with more critical thinking than that, and realize that if you're only going to male sources, you're sending the message that that's who the experts are. And you name the field, there are plenty of women experts in every possible field, but you have to be intentional about it. And I think that when we have more women in the press who have those relationships with women who are experts, you're going to see a different kind of a populate. You're going to populate the pieces very differently. And I think that's all a good thing, because again, I get back to the underlying premise here, which is diversity is a strength.
Do you think there are any particular media narratives that are moving around this cycle that would have been covered differently? I think that one of the ones I can think of is that, suburban women flipping, that people feel like they're a fascinating group they can't get enough of. I guess maybe because they covered white rural men voting for Trump enough times in 2017. So now they've moved to women. But do you think there are like any particular narratives that you think would have been covered differently?
Well, so first of all, could we dissect the phrase suburban housewife? I mean, I grew up watching Leave It to Beaver, and, you know, June was a suburban housewife. But do you really think that women who live in the suburbs today want to be described that way? I bet they don't. And right now, I don't think that they're worried about Black people moving next door to them. I think they're worried about, how am I going to homeschool my child or send them to school, and wonder, are they going to be safe? I wonder whether we're still going to have the ability to put food on the table. I worry about, am I going to send my parent to a nursing home or a hospital when they're sick and not be able to see them when they're dying? I'm worried about our livelihood. I think some of the narrative that you're seeing that falls into those kind of historic nomenclature, it's going to backfire, because that's actually not where women are today. Those are not the issues that this minute that they are struggling with. And so I think it's playing to, you know, it's playing to yesteryear, and that the candidates, regardless of party, who actually know the people who live in their communities and what's going on in their lives, are the ones that are going to feel that connection and are going to actually win.
So when Trump held his rally last week, the first one that he came off of after being hospitalized from COVID, he said at the rally, stood on stage, he's repeated again since at his rallies, he said, suburban women like me. Like, he actually said it out loud. Someone said he did the quiet part out loud. Do you think that's going to work?
Okay, so let's just be really clear. For this part of the conversation, I'm taking off my When We All Vote hat, which is a nonpartisan role, and I'm talking to you just as Valerie. No, I don't think it's going to work. I think he's playing to a shrinking base, an older base, a predominantly male base. And within that base, they are extraordinarily passionate and committed to him. That's why they show up at rallies without masks, even though every expert tells them they should wear a mask and social distance. And for some reason, he's willing to put his supporters in harm's way. And they go, and they follow him. And they say, if he told me to wear a mask, I would, which I find so devastating that he won't say those simple words in earnest to his supporters. But the rhetoric at the rallies, the language about lock them up, the pejorative way that he referred to Governor Whitmer in Michigan, who's just experienced something that professionally and personally you shouldn't have to go through. We've seen just recently tonight, Dr. Fauci, or last night on 60 Minutes, was talking about the people who are harassing not just him, but his family, the threats that they are receiving. I think that most Americans are good and decent people, and it is repugnant to them the way the rhetoric is being used, is being weaponized, the way social media is being weaponized to separate us and pull us apart at a time when what we need most is to pull us together. And I mean, every time in our nation's history where we've made progress, Emily, it has been when we have rallied. We've had disruption, we've had demonstrations, but we've had rallying of people coming together. You think of after 9/11, not only did we rally, the world rallied for us. Who's rallying for America today? Who's rooting for us today? People feel sorry for us, and we're the laughingstock of the world today. And so I think that is repugnant to most Americans. and they don't think that it reflects our values. Our standing in the world has dropped, and that's not where we want to be.
So I want to ask you specifically about the women who voted for Trump. I think there is intrigue around them. Some of the analysis from 2016 is that many of the women who had voted for Trump did so because their husbands did. And honestly, I never really accepted that as an answer. I think that people take ownership over their own choices. And so I'm not totally convinced about that. Many of them ended up then flipping immediately in the congressional midterms in 2018 and voting for Democratic congressional mm-hmm. races. But do you think that the scare, so you would think of them, if they voted for Trump once, they could potentially vote for Trump again. Do you think that the scare tactics that Trump is trying to use are going to work if they're kind of loose Democratic voters having only voted for Democrats in a midterm election?
Well, so as you know, women are not a homogeneous group either. So I think it depends. And I will say President Trump won every demographic of white women, from low income to very wealthy. He won them all. But I think that also 100 million eligible voters didn't vote. And that's a big number, even in the United States. And so I think there has been a wake-up call. And he was running aspirationally, as all candidates do who are not yet elected. But now he's running on a track record. And I think that the lived experience that many women in our country have, they don't need their husband to tell them what their life has been like under President Trump. They don't need their husband to interpret the kind of rhetoric and policies and language that President Trump has used. Women who have children, you think that they enjoyed seeing families being separated at the border? I don't think so. And so I think we've had a cumulative impact of both laws, policies, rhetoric, and tone that is offensive to large numbers of women. Some women may be influenced by their husbands if they haven't been paying attention to a political campaign, but now you're talking about a sitting president. And in a time where so many of us have been affected by this COVID-19, I think they're paying attention in a very concrete way right now because of their lived experiences. But it will vary depending on women. I'm sure that there are some women, which is why I don't pay a lot of attention to the polls. I bet there's some people who aren't being honest when they're called by pollsters because they don't want to actually admit that they're supporting President Trump. I think this race could be closer than we think it could be based on polling today. And let's face it, in 2016, Hillary Clinton was way ahead at this point in the race, and that gap went away. So back to your earlier question, for people who think that their vote doesn't matter, this race could be much closer than you think. And so do not wake up the day after and go, what if I voted? Again, don't do that, please.
So not to play out doomsday scenarios, but we could potentially end up in a situation where the in-person votes that are counted on election day are people who are not nervous about COVID. So more likely than not Trump supporters. So those votes will be counted immediately. People who were more nervous about voting in person because of COVID and therefore voted by mail, more likely Biden supporters. So those votes would get counted in the days to come after election day. So we could end up in a scenario where on election night, it looks like Trump is winning, but then his margin decreases over the next couple of days to weeks as the votes get counted in for Biden. And it could end up going potentially in a lawsuit to the Supreme Court. Do you worry about a constitutional crisis? Like, how do we get ourselves out of this? Like, how do we decide that we are better as a country together than rooting for our own candidate?
Well, see, now this is where, the answer to your question is yes, it keeps me up at night worrying about this fact because of some of the language that President Trump has been using. When he says, when the question is put to him, will you support a peaceful transition of power, something that has happened throughout our history, regardless of party? And he says, maybe not. He's quite unclear about that. And then implying that if he doesn't win, then there must have been some nefarious act going on, as opposed to you just didn't get as many votes. And it is seeding.
I feel like I heard my toddler use that excuse, by the way. Like I heard it, probably earlier today.
I'm sure you did. But what it's doing that worries me, it is seeding in the psyche of the American people that they should question the integrity of the election. And that has not happened before. We know that the Russians tried to interfere with our last election, but you didn't have people wondering whether Americans were in there, that somehow voting by mail that has been going on with the military since the Civil War, and certainly in states the president votes absentee, that's been, has not been questioned before. And now suddenly we're questioning it. And I do remember last time when he was behind in the polls to Hillary, he started saying, well, it's probably being rigged, kind of setting the expectation that if he lost, that he didn't lose on the up and up. And I think that's such a dangerous game to be playing in our country where, again, the foundation of our democracy is the integrity of the election. And I do think that, to your point, seeding some distrust about the competency of the post office is legitimate. They do not have the resources that they need to handle this influx of mail, which is why I think we see so many people opting to vote early, is that they don't want to show up on election day. They don't want to put their ballot in the mailbox. And so they're going to early vote. And that seems to be where a lot of folks are trending. But we could end up in the situation that you talked about, where more Democrats vote absentee. And what I'm hoping is that the people in his own party who recognize that we have to count every ballot, manage expectations of the American people, and that we don't experience civil unrest during that period. And it would be very helpful if President Trump would tone down his rhetoric and the fueling of the sense of outrage, encouraging people to take matters in their own hand and be poll watchers, not trained poll watchers, but just show up at the polls, which will act as a way of suppressing the vote and intimidating people. There are people who are responsible for making sure our elections are open and fair, and we should count on them to do it. And if they do a bad job, the way we're seeing right now in states like Georgia, well, then you should vote out the Secretary of State. You have a way of tackling when you stand in line for 12 hours. Don't vote for the person who is responsible for that election the next time.
I have a friend who's doing nonpartisan poll watching today in North Carolina in their early vote, and he was sending me some images that there was a Trump supporter there who called himself a poll watcher, no mask, and yelling into a bullhorn at people up and down the line. And so my friend who's there is a nonpartisan attorney, but just saying that, you know, you're electioneering here and can you please wear a mask? And it was unpleasant and just kind of had to like keep an eye on him all day. So you know, there's more subtle forms of voter intimidation, yeah. I think, than we even realize.
Yeah, and what the president is doing is he's licensing that. He's saying, do it. He's affirmatively saying, show up and protect our elections, as opposed to respecting the people whose job it is to do so. Democracy is supposed to abide by the rule of law, not having citizens taking law into their own hands.
So I want to switch gears a little bit and just ask you a personal question before we get into the viewer questions. We're getting some good ones coming in through the chat, and we're definitely going to switch over to those in a couple minutes. But so for me, having children is totally linked to the end of the Obama administration and the last 4 years, because I got married at the end of the administration, had my first child at the end of the administration, 5 days after the convention, when I saw Hillary Clinton take the nomination, and went back to work the day after the election. And then I've had 3 kids in that time. So motherhood and working is like totally interlock with me with these last couple of years, which feels insane, but I guess it always was going to feel insane. But so my mom mentor, the person who talked me through how I was going to be able to do it, stay sane, I was going to be okay, worked for you at the time. Paulette Aniskov was working for you in the White House, and she was the person that told me I was going to be okay and I wasn't going to totally lose my career, and we were going to be able to manage it. And so I asked her over and over how I was going to be able to do it. And basically, you know that she had a baby in about the same time frame that I did. And her answer to me was basically work with Valerie Jarrett. It was like basically her answer of how we could manage it all. So we'd all love to work for you. We all wish we could do it. But for those of us that can't, how do we take the lessons of the team that you were able to lead? I mean, you were at the pinnacle of power. I mean, you were running the White House. Like how do we, so none of us have an excuse that we can't do it in our workplaces if you could do it. So how do we take the lessons from the leadership that you had to be able to keep working mothers in the fold and not just keep us in the fold, but actually encourage us?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I love Paulette. Just hearing her name makes me smile. Well, let's go way back. So when I first finished school, I practiced law at a couple big law firms. And there weren't a lot of people who looked like me or had my life experiences there. And I found myself doing everything humanly possible to try to be one of the guys. I put up with sexist jokes. I traveled with the guys and stayed up late with them, even though I was exhausted and didn't really want to hang out in the bars. I put up with nonsense at Halloween, or not, at holiday parties that I shouldn't have had to, that I should have had the courage to say, don't do that. I turned the other way more times than I am proud to admit. And I can even remember being like in a meeting, closing a deal at like 1 or 2 in the morning. And I kept getting up and I'd say, well, I'm going to check my voicemail back before we had cell phones, or I'm going to the Xerox machine back when we had Xerox machines, or the vending machine. Well, where was I going? Where do you go when you're 8.5 months pregnant? You go to the bathroom all the time. And I kept trying to pretend like nothing's happening below here, and to my detriment. And I never complained, and I convinced myself I was superhuman and I could do everything myself. And my marriage fell apart not too long after my daughter was born. And then I really was going to do everything myself because I had to prove I was competent. And I started dropping balls all over the place. And my mother said to me, why don't you ask for help? And to me, it made me vulnerable and weak and miserable. I could almost start to cry going back to the memory of how I felt when I had to ask for help. And those memories, 35 years later, are still searing to me. And so I made up my mind that I am. And importantly, not only did I have my mother, but I had a client at work. I left the law firm and I joined city government. I had an amazing client who was in the mayor's office who had a daughter who was 16. And so she looked at me, single mom with a 2-year-old. And I opened up and I told her everything. I just poured out my heart to her. And what happened? She started to actually care about me. And she supported me and she advocated for me. And she really built my confidence up and made me learn to advocate for myself, all of which I describe in my book. And so I said, if I'm ever in a position to help the next generation of women not have to go through what I went through, some of which was self-inflicted, then I'm going to do it. And for the women who don't have a voice, who can't speak up for themselves, I'm going to be that voice. And so you described Paulette. Paulette came to me and she said, you know, I'm giving you like 6 months notice because I'm going to be leaving. And I'm like, you're not going anywhere. Why would you leave? And she said, well, I want to have children. And I don't think I can do it in the White House. I'm like, oh, yes, you can. And I'd already been through that with Cecilia Munoz and a couple of other women. I'm like, oh, no, no, we're going to do this together and we're going to communicate. And I promise you, you are going to work hard and you're going to be where you need to be to support your children. And you're not going to be perfect at any of it. And I'd rather have you less than perfect than lose you. And I think that's something else we have to get comfortable with, is that life is full of trade-offs. If you decide to have 3 children, then you're not going to be able to work in the exact same way as I do when I have a grown child and a grandson. And that at different chapters of your life, you can put your foot down and pull it up. And if you have a partner, then I think that for the younger generation, there's a little bit more equality going on. My son-in-law does a lot more than my dad, let alone my husband, ever did to be helpful to the family unit. And I think we have to find our voices in that way. And if we can't advocate for ourselves, then that's why we need other people to do it. But Paulette could have just quit and I would have never known why. And I think what I try to do is to keep enough of a dialogue open with all of the people on my team, not just the women, so that I knew what was going on in their lives and they could bring their full self to the office. And in return, I think they were more productive and I could read them and know what was going on. I mean, my father died while I was working in the White House. If people hadn't known that, they would have just wondered why I was acting so strange. But I was very open about it. And I think stop pretending and be more honest. And I say making yourself vulnerable in that way could be risky, but it's where relationships are forged. And that's the elixir of life. The reason I brighten up when you say Paulette is because I know Paulette and her 2 boys and her husband. And if she'd never shared that with me, then I would have said, oh yeah, Paulette, I remember she used to be on my team. No, I love her.
Well, thanks for you to you for setting that example. And thanks for Paulette to inviting me to the White House once I had the baby, that I now actually have a picture of me, of my son being changed in the bathroom in the West Wing. And I will treasure that. That's good, right? That's good. We have some great questions coming in from the audience. So I want to jump over here.
Okay.
We had a question up at the beginning talking about voting. You're talking about voting information. That local is so important, but it's very hard to find good information. For instance, in the judge categories, like you were talking about, they have a lot of cross-party endorsements, as here in New York State, where 92nd Street Y is. So where do you recommend that people head for this kind of information?
Yeah, I was thinking, I saw that come in and I was thinking, I would say go to organizations like the League of Women Voters. They could point you locally in the right direction. They have chapters all over the country. You want to find organizations on the ground. So don't listen to me to tell you who you should vote for in Pennsylvania, because I can just barely tell you Cook County and Chicago. You need to find those organizations that are trusted, that have a good track record, that do their homework. If you have confidence in a local newspaper, oftentimes they run endorsements. I don't actually have confidence in the newspapers in Chicago to trust their judgment, but I used to back in the day. So you've got to find a source that's reliable. But I do think the League can steer you in the right direction.
And finding good local organizations that are really in the weeds and that can make a big difference.
Yeah, like the, you know, the YWCA. They are another huge organization with local chapters all around the country. I bet they could be helpful steering you in the right direction too.
Okay, here's a question that we may not even have time for this, but it says, how do you actually bring people back together?
Well, I don't think it's as hard as it might seem, because I do think that, again, most people are good and decent, and they are not enjoying our current state. I think you just need leadership, and you need people to feel the power of their own individual voices and the collective force that they can bring together. And it begins with each and every one of you who's tuning in. And, you know, are you treating people decently? Like right now, for example, I'm in New York and I go to the grocery store. I have a grocery store right near my home. I always thank the people in the grocery store. I have a feeling that they don't get thanked a lot in the course of the day. It's a small thing, but it's like something I can intentionally say, you know, thank you. You're putting yourself in harm's way. I'm scared to come in here and you're in here all day long. Just be decent yourself. And if enough of us do that and we start voting for people who treat people well as well, then that's when change starts to happen. So I think we are hungry in this country to come back together again. People have tried to scare us for the last 4 years and it's exhausting. And actually before that, I mean, look, I'm talking about Senator Harris being described as an other. President Obama was, the whole birther nonsense was based on delegitimizing his candidacy and then his presidency as to whether he was born in this country. This, you know, notion that he was a Muslim, made up fanciful conspiracy theories online. And there will always be some of that, but I don't think it reflects the true spirit. So yes, I think we needed somebody toned to be set at the top, but in the absence of that, there's certainly something each and every one of us could do.
Well, here's sort of a related question, but does it scare you how politicized the actual voting, the actual process of voting has become?
Yeah. Look, it scares me how political a pandemic has become. You know, the fact that people think wearing masks is a political statement as opposed to a way of preventing the transmission of a disease is terrifying. It's not logical. But again, it shows you that leadership is powerful. Elections have consequences. And if people trust their leaders, they will follow them into some very dark places. And so that's why I think we need a change in leadership.
I watched Joe Biden's town hall last week, and he said something that was a very simple statement, but really struck me, was that he said the words the president uses matters.
Yeah, they do. They're extraordinarily influential. And I thought you were going to say, I agree with you completely about that statement, Emily. But the other thing that he said that resonated with me is he said, look, I'm running as a Democrat. I will govern as the president of America. And I think we want that. I want a president who cares about me and my life. And even if I disagree with him, I want him to think that he works for me and not for himself. And I think that not just in the in the White House, but in Congress as well. I'm so tired of them putting short-term interests ahead of what's good for our country. And the House passed a bill to help America deal with the economic fallout of this pandemic in May. This is October, and the Senate has not acted yet. And they're taking time to confirm a Supreme Court justice as opposed to helping the American people deal with this pandemic. And I find that stunning. And certainly for the 8 years I was in the White House, it was the one thing I was really fully unprepared for, is this willingness to put politics over country. And I think it's part of why I enjoyed Cindy McCain's endorsement of Vice President Biden, and reminding everyone that Cindy McCain's husband, John McCain, a war hero, ran against President Obama. But she said, you know, country first. That's what her husband believed.
I spent a lot of time, I used to do a lot of Fox News commentary, and especially around Merrick Garland's non-confirmation. And I was kind of struck by the green room chatter then was, well, we're in power. What do you think we would do? What would you expect the response to be? Of course, we're not going to confirm him, even though they knew that the Senate had the votes to actually confirm, they wouldn't bring him up for a vote. And I feel like we're at the extreme. I mean, obviously, we're at the extreme version of that now. But I was kind of struck when there was even discussion. I mean, within minutes of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg passing, that Mitch McConnell's statement came out and basically said, well, we're in power. What do you think we're going to do?
Yeah, and Lindsey Graham, who before Justice Ginsburg's death said, of course we would not confirm anybody in an election year, and you can hold me to that. And I give you my word that we wouldn't do that. And then he flipped. And you know what? He's in a really tight race now in South Carolina. I certainly hope he loses, because he's not a man of his word. There's also a very powerful video with him tearing up, talking about what a good man Joe Biden is, what a decent man Joe Biden is. And yet now he says perfectly dreadful things about Joe Biden. And I think that the sad part about this, well, there's many sad parts about it, but the thing I think that troubles me most is people are losing confidence in their elected leaders. And they're beginning to question them in ways that we haven't. And I think in part is you're seeing them erode the social norms that are an important part of our democracy too. The laws are important, but we also have an added buffer of social norms. And those norms, I mean, to have a Democrat, I have a Republican convention at the White House, using the White House as a prop for a convention, using a church and a Bible as a prop for why you would disperse a peaceful demonstration of Americans. I mean, these are things that we just don't do in our country. And so we are fighting for the soul of our country. Joe's right.
Well, maybe you just answered this next question already, but young people typically don't vote. Do you think that changes this year?
I do. And I'll tell you, I've become buddies with a couple of the kids from Parkland. And obviously, they experienced the worst tragedy that a high school student should have to go through when their classmates were murdered. And they channeled that anger and frustration, as you all know, into the largest single day demonstration in our nation's history with March for Our Lives a few years ago, and all about ending gun violence. And they traveled, several of them, traveled the country in the summer of 2018, red states, blue states alike, registering people to vote about this issue, because they thought that that would resonate better with young people. Rather than saying affiliate yourself with a party, when young people don't affiliate themselves in that way necessarily, they said affiliate yourself with an issue, and then find out, again, being an educated voter, where do people stand on these issues? And they've been very successful in getting folks, young people, registered to vote. And part of what When We All Vote is doing, again, since it is nonpartisan, is to meet people where they are and begin the conversation about, tell us the issues you care about, and to have influencers who can influence. And so young people are the best influencers for other young people. So I give a huge shout out to those young people and so many more around the country who are focusing on voter registration. When We All Vote has an initiative with high school students and college and university students, where we're encouraging them, and it's obviously harder to do when many are not on campuses, but to go to their peers. And for the first time voters, the evidence shows, Emily, that if you vote in your first election, the chances of you becoming a lifelong voter goes up. And so not only do they not vote in high numbers, but if we can get them to vote, then they will be more likely to be a lifelong voter. And so we're using a whole group of ambassadors who can influence that cohort to go out and talk about the issues and engage the citizenry.
I have to tell you, I'm really impressed by a lot of the young people, especially a lot of the young influencers. I'm working on a project now with a bunch of them where they asked me to come in and basically guide them through what some good political commentary would be. Mm-hmm. And so they gave me a list of who they are. I mean, I've never heard of a single one of them, like never heard of them. So I'm like Googling them.
Yeah.
1 million followers, 10 million followers. I've never heard of these people. And they're 17 and 18 years old, and they have a big track record in their in the content they put out, that they are not afraid of taking a stand. And I really respect them using their platform for that.
Yes, and I do think as a result of the last nearly 4 years, the level of activism that we're seeing, where people are saying, well, you know what? We can't just say it doesn't matter who's in office. We can't just ignore this. We have to use our voices in a way where we can influence, not just about what you wear or what music you listen to or movies you watch, but the serious matter of who is representing our country and making decisions about how to spend our taxpayer dollars in a way that influences our lives and our livelihood. And I think that's outstanding. And we've seen, you know, activism just more generally, as we mentioned earlier, in connection with the racial tensions that we have in our country this summer. And I was heartened to see that those demonstrations were comprised of people of all races and all backgrounds and all ages coming together and say, you know what, Black lives do matter. And that's how we make progress. That's the first step, is you use your voice and you demonstrate. And that pressure has influenced both ensuring a swift and decisive decision to indict the four officers in George Floyd's death, to cities passing laws prohibiting the chokehold and no-knock warrants. Congress still has not acted, but we are seeing changes on the ground. And then the next challenge is voting. You have to demonstrate and use your voice, and you have to vote and use your voice. And then after you vote, you have to hold whoever's in office accountable again. And so there's never a time where you can say, okay, we're done, let's go home now. The art of perfecting our union should be a lifelong goal for each of us.
Well, I'm glad you brought us back here, because I had actually meant to come back here a little while ago, that there ends up being a lot of conversation about the voting habits of white women, I think particularly because they flipped in the last couple of years. So it makes a very interesting conversation. But we don't spend enough time talking about the fact that 92% of Black women do vote Democratic and did vote for Hillary Clinton, and are the drivers basically of Democratic policy. And I think because they vote in such strong numbers that they often end up getting taken for granted. So how do you think that we center Black women as the drivers in the conversation, as opposed to taking them for granted as the drivers in the conversation?
Well, one thing that's happened that the media has and the pollsters have done, which I think is a good step, is that they are now looking at the data and seeing, oh, well, not only do Black women vote, but in the case, for example, of Doug Jones in Alabama, they were determinative of the outcome of the race. Well, I assure you, Doug Jones knows that. And he feels he feels beholden to this strong base of Black women in Alabama. And because that data point came out so clearly, you're seeing, you know, the press is following that now more closely and more carefully. And I do not think that Black women feel taken for granted. I think they feel empowered. And many of them working with us, many organizations working with When We All Vote on voter registration and turnout, recognizing that not only do they vote, but they have the ability to influence other people who vote as well.
Absolutely. So we can't jump up without asking you, what is your voting plan? We know what your mother's is. What is your voting plan?
No, I don't have it in this room, but I voted already. I voted absentee ballot a couple weeks ago. I requested my ballot the day that I was eligible to request it. It went out from Chicago Elections Commission promptly. In Chicago, you can track it. So it sent me an email saying your ballot has been mailed. So I looked for it. And then when I sent it back in, it told me when it had arrived back at the election commission and had been logged in as meeting the requirements. So it will be counted. So I am done. And I would hope everybody out there, figure your plan out today. Please don't wait till the last minute, because things come up. They inevitably do. And I just, I don't want anybody waiting any longer than absolutely necessary. And so if you are comfortable during the early vote, I think that's the way to go. And give yourself, you know, a couple of days. If you go on one day and there's a long line, maybe try it a different time another day. But if you want to vote absentee, I really just get it done right away. I am confident the Postal Service isn't prepared because of many of the practices and policies that the Secretary of the United States Postal Service put in place to try to reduce our ability to deliver mail in a punctual way, as we saw in the primaries. And we know it's going to happen again.
Right. I mean, not knowing what your plan is and being able to plan in advance for that is such an important part of it. I had at first planned on voting absentee, so I requested my absentee ballot. Then I was planning to vote early in person to make sure that my vote got counted on election day. And as we were just discussing before this started, that my family has now been exposed to COVID, so we are quarantined. So I'm happy that I already have my absentee ballot.
See?
Because I can send it in, and I don't have to worry about being able to go to a polling place in person, even though we tested negative, but we're still quarantined. So just to put that out there, but I'm happy that I now have the ballot because everything is unpredictable right now. I mean, I thought it would be unpredictable just because I have a lot of young kids, but it turns out it was also unpredictable because we were exposed to COVID.
You are an excellent case study in why you need a plan and a backup.
We've had a lot of plans. So thank you so much for joining us. We've really covered a ton of issues. We loved hearing your perspective. Thank you so much. I'm going to go over and make sure everyone around me has backup plans too for voting.
Please do. And everybody out there tuning in, do not wake up the next day with any regrets that you didn't do what you could do. This is a really important election. And I think it's going to be terrific when women make all of the difference in the world. And we can do that. It's in our hands. So, and stay safe. Wear a mask. No matter what anybody tells you, wear a mask. All right, everybody. Thank you. Thank you, Emily. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye now.